Your It continues with Session 10, Oriental Philosophy in the West, Part 2.
I want to start by re-emphasizing the point that what are called the religions of the East, the ones we're discussing, Hinduism, Buddhism, and Chinese Taoism, are not what we in the West understand as religions. They don't involve that you believe in anything specific. And they don't involve any idea of obedience to commandments from above. And they don't involve any conformity to a specific ritual. Although they do have rituals, but their rituals vary from country to country and from time to time. Their objective is always not ideas, not doctrines, but a method for the transformation of consciousness. That is to say, for a transformation of your sensation of who you are. And I emphasize the word sensation because it's the strongest word we have for feeling directly. When you put your hand on the corner of a table, you have a very definite feeling. And when you are aware of existing, you also have a definite feeling. But in the view of these methods or disciplines, the ordinary person's definite feeling of the way he exists and who he is a hallucination. To feel yourself as a separate ego, a source of action and awareness that is entirely separate and independent from the rest of the world, somehow locked up inside a bag of skin, is seen as a hallucination. That you are not a stranger in the earth, that comes into this world either as a result of a natural fluke or being a sort of spirit that comes from somewhere else altogether. But that you, in your fundamental existence, you are the total energy that constitutes this universe. Playing that it's you. Playing that it's this particular organism. And even playing that it's this particular person. Because the fundamental game of the world is a game of hide and seek. That is to say that the colossal reality, the energy that is everything, that is a unitary energy, that is one, plays at being many, at manifesting itself in all these particulars that we call you and 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 this and that and all around us. And it's fundamentally a game. And you can say that this goes really for all the systems that I'm talking about. It's the basis of Hinduism, of Buddhism, and of Taoism. This intuition. Now today we're going to talk about Buddhism. Shortly after 600 BC, there was a young prince by the name of Gautama Siddhartha who became the man we call the Buddha. Now, the word Buddha is not a proper name, it's a title. And it's based on the Sanskrit root Budh, B-U-D-H, which means to be awake. And so you could say the Buddha is the man who woke up from the dream of life as we ordinarily take it to be and found out who he was, who he is. It's curious that this title was not something new. There was already in the whole complex of Hinduism the idea of Buddhas, of awakened people And curiously, they are ranked higher than gods. Because in the view of Hinduism, even the gods, or the angels, the devas, are still bound on the wheel of the sort of squirrel cage of going round and round and round in the pursuit of success. And the idea is that if you pursue something that you can call success, pleasure, good, virtue, which originally, of course, means strength, magical power, all these positive things, you are under illusion because the positive cannot exist without the negative. To be, you only know what to be is by contrast with not to be. So if we say, now, there is a coin in the left hand, there is no coin in the right. And from this you get the idea of to be and not to be. And you can't have the one without the other. So if you try to pursue, to gain the positive, and to deny, get rid of the negative, it's as if you were trying to arrange everything in this room so that it was all up and nothing was down. You can't do it. You set yourself an absolutely insoluble problem. Because the basis of life is spectrum. I'll consider the spectrum of colors. When you think of a spectrum, in what form do you think of it? Most people think of it as a ribbon, with red at one end and purple at the other. But the spectrum is actually a circle. Because purple is the mixture of red and blue. It goes right round. And so in this way, all sensation, all feeling, all experience whatsoever is moving through spectra. You don't only have the spectrum of color, you have a spectrum of sound, you have various complex spectra of texture, of smell, of taste, and you're constantly operating through all the possible variations of experience. And it implies that you can't know one end of the spectrum without also knowing the other. So if you wanted, say your favorite color is red, and you wanted only red, and you had to exclude, therefore, blue and purple. Without blue and purple, you can't have red. Behind, of course, all the various colors in the spectrum is the white light. And behind everything that we experience, all our various sensations of sound, of color, of shape, of touch, there's the white light. And I'm using the phrase the white light rather symbolically. I don't mean it literally. But there is common to all sensations what you might call the basic sense. And if you explore back into your sensations and reduce them all to the basic sense, you're on your way to reality, to what underlies everything, to what is the ground of being, the basic energy. And to the extent that you realize this and know that you are it, you transcend, you overcome, you surpass the illusion that you are simply John Doe, Mary Smith, or what have you. So then, the Buddha, as the man who woke up, is regarded as one Buddha among a potentiality of myriads of Buddhas. Everybody can be a Buddha. Everybody has in himself the capacity to wake up from the illusion of being simply this separate individual. The Buddha made his doctrine very easy to understand, because in those days there wasn't very much writing being done, and people committed things to memory. And so he put his doctrine or method in various formulae, which are very easy to remember, and I'm going to explain it in those terms so that you can remember it just as well. He, of course, practiced the various disciplines that were offered in the Hinduism of his time. But he found in a certain way that they had become unsatisfactory, because they had overemphasized asceticism, had overemphasized putting up with as much pain as you can. There was a feeling, you see, that if the problem of life is pain, let us suffer. And this is the root of the ascetics, you see, who lie on beds of nails, who hold a hand up forever and ever and ever, who eat only one banana a day, who renounce sex, who do all these weird things, because they feel that if they head right into pain and don't become afraid of it, but suffer as much pain as possible, they will, by this method, overcome the problem of pain. And they will set themselves free from anxiety. There's a certain sense in that, as you can obviously see. Supposing, for example, you have absolutely no fear of pain. You have no anxieties. You have no hang-ups. How strong you would be. Nobody could stop you. You would have ultimate courage. But the Buddha was very subtle. He is really the first historical psychologist, the great psychologist, psychotherapist. He is very subtle because he saw that a person who is fighting pain, who is trying to get rid of pain, is still really fundamentally afraid of it. And therefore, the way of asceticism is not right. Equally, the way of hedonism, of seeking pleasure, is not right. So the Buddha's doctrine is called the middle way, which is neither ascetic nor hedonistic. So it's summed up in what are called the Four Noble Truths. And the first is called dukkha. Dukkha means suffering in a very generalized sense. You could call it chronic frustration. And it is saying that life as lived by most people is dukkha. Is an attempt, in other words, to solve insoluble problems. Try to draw a square circle. You can't, because the problem itself is meaningless. Try to arrange the things in this room so that they're all up and none of them down. It is meaningless. Such a problem cannot ever be solved. So try to have light without dark, or dark without light. It can never be solved. So the attempt to solve problems that are basically insoluble and to work at it through your whole life, that is dukkha. Now, he went on to analyze this, that there are what he called three signs of being. The first is dukkha itself, frustration. The second is anitya, and this means the letter A in Sanskrit at the beginning of a word is often the equivalent of our non. So nitya means permanent, anitya means impermanent, that every manifestation of life is impermanent, and therefore our quest to make things permanent to straighten everything out, to get it fixed, is an impossible and insoluble problem. And therefore, we experience dukkha, or this sense of fundamental pain and frustration, as a result of trying to make things permanent. And the third sign of being is called anatman. Now, you know from my talk on Hinduism that the word atman means self. Anatman means, therefore, non-self. That there is in you no real ego. Now, I've explained that already. I've explained, in talking about Hinduism, that the idea of the ego is a social institution. It has no physical reality. It is simply, the ego is your symbol of yourself. Just as the word water is a noise which symbolizes a certain liquid reality, so the idea of the ego, the role you play, who you are, is not the same as your living organism. Your ego has absolutely nothing to do with the way you color your eyes, shape your body, circulate your blood. That's the real you, but it's certainly not your ego, because you don't even know how it's done from the standpoint of your conscious attention. So the idea of anatman is firstly that the ego is unreal. There isn't one. Now then is the first truth. There is this situation that we have dukkha or frustration because we are fighting the changingness of things and because we don't realize that the ego, the I, is unreal. The second of the Four Noble Truths is then called Krishna. Krishna is a Sanskrit word again and is the root of our word thirst. And it's usually translated desire, but it is better translated clinging, grabbing. Or there's an excellent modern American slangy word, hang up. That is exactly what Krishna is, a hang up. Krishna is clutching. As, for example, what we call smother love. When a mother is so afraid that her children may get into trouble, that she protects them excessively. And as a result of this, prevents them from growing. Or when lovers cling to each other excessively and have to sign documents that they will curse and swear to love each other always, they are in a state of Trishna. And this is the same thing as holding on to yourself so tightly that you strangle yourself. Now, so the second truth then about Trishna is that the cause of dukkha is Trishna. Clinging is what makes suffering. If you don't recognize that this whole world is a phantasmagoria, an amazing illusion, a weaving of smoke, and you try to hold on to it, you see, then you start suffering, seriously suffering. Krishna is in turn based upon avidya. The same negative, vidya, from the root vid, means knowledge, as in the Latin video and the English vision. Avidya, therefore, is ignorance. Gnosis, gna, means, of course, to know. Knowledge is the same thing as gnosis in Greek. to know. So this is not to know, to ignore, to overlook. We ignore all kinds of things because we notice only what we think noteworthy. And therefore our vision of everything is highly selective. We pick out certain things and say that's what's there, just as we select and notice the figure rather than the background. Sometimes I draw this on the blackboard and ask the question, what have I drawn? What would you say? What have I drawn? A circle. Any other suggestions?
A hole in the black.
Yeah, you're getting the point. I've drawn a wall with a hole in it, you see. But ordinarily, you've been reading my books. But ordinarily people see the ball, the circle, the ring or whatever, and never think of the background. Because they ignore the background. Just as one thinks that you can have pleasure without pain. You want pleasure of the figure, and don't realize that pain is the background. So, avidya is this state of restricted consciousness, restricted attention, that moves through life unaware of the fact that to be implies not to be, and vice versa. So now the third noble truth is called nirvana. This word means blow out. Nir is a negative word, again, like ah. Vana is blowing. So it's a kind of outblowing. Now, in breathing, you know that breath is life. The Greek word, you may pronounce it pneuma or pneuma, is the same as spirit. And spirit means breath. In the book of Genesis, when God had made the clay figurine that was later to be Adam, he breathed the breath of life into its nostrils. And it became alive, because life is breath. But now, if you hold your breath, you lose it. He that would save his life will lose it. So breathe in, breathe in, breathe in, get as much air as you can, and Trishna, cling, and you lose it. So nirvana means breathe out. What a relief that was. The sigh of relief. Let it go. Because it'll come back to you if you let it go. But if you don't let it go, you'll just suffocate. So a person in the state of nirvana is what we might call a blown out person. Like blow your mind. Let go. Don't cling. And then you're in the state of nirvana. And I re-emphasize the point. This is not, I'm not preaching, see? I'm not saying this is what you ought to do. I'm simply pointing out a state of affairs that is so. There's no moralism in this whatsoever. It's simply pointing out, like, if you put your hand into the fire, you'll get burned. You can get burned if you want to. That's okay. But if it so happens that you don't want to get burned, and you don't put your hand in the fire. So in the same way, if you don't want to be in a state of anxiety all the time, and again I emphasize, if you like to be anxious, it's perfectly all right. Buddhism never hurries anyone on. They say, you've got all eternity through which to live in various forms. And therefore, you don't have just one life in which you've got to avoid eternal damnation. You can go running around the wheel and the rat race and play that game just as long as you want to, so long as you think it's fun. But if there comes a time when you don't think it's fun, you don't have to do it. So I wouldn't say to anyone who disagrees with me and who says, I think we ought to engage the forces of evil in battle and put this world to right and so on and so forth and arrange everything in this world so that it's all up. Try it, please. It's perfectly okay. Go on doing that. But if you see that it's futile, then you can let go. Don't try to cling. Relax. And if you do that, you're in the state of nirvana. And you become a Buddha. And of course it means that you become a rather astonishing person. You may, of course, be subtle about it. And make like you're a very ordinary person. So that you don't get people mixed up. Because if you are a very astonishing person, everybody wants to be like you. And they use you as an object of trishna, of clinging. They rely on you. You get a transference on you. Everybody comes running around and says, please help me. I'd like to be like you are. And then you have to get rid of them. See, that's the difference between a doctor and a clergyman. I shouldn't say things like this, but doctors try to get rid of their patients. Clergymen try to get them hooked on the medicine so that they will become addicts to the church. And that's too bad, because there is a saying in ancient Christianity, crux medicina mundi, which means the cross, the medicine of the world. But you don't make medicine a diet. And so in Buddhism, the Buddha explained that his doctrine, his method, was a raft. It's sometimes called a yana. The word yana, yana, means a vehicle, a conveyance. And when you cross a river on a raft, and you get to the other shore, you don't pick up the raft and carry it on your back. You leave it behind. But people who are what I would call hooked on religion are always on the raft. They're going back and forth, back and forth, back and forth on the raft. So the clergyman tends to turn into a ferryman who's always on the raft and never gets over to the other shore himself. Now, something to be said for that, because how are we going to get the raft back to the first shore to bring over the other people? See? Somebody has to volunteer to take the back journey. But he must be awfully careful to realize that the real objective is to get the people across and set them free. If you dedicate yourself to ferrying people across, don't ask them to come back on the raft with you. Because you'll get overcrowded, and people will think that the raft is the goal rather than the other shore. So when I find this in actual practice, that when clergymen do not ever ask for money, and it's all right, you know, like a doctor who simply charges a fee, says, you come to me, you pay me so much. But the clergyman says, he doesn't say pay me so much, he says, we would like your pledge, your voluntary contribution. See, and then nobody knows what to give. But he has to go calling around all sorts of places. He becomes a fundraiser for this big project, the church. And it's a bad scene. Because if any church were really successful in liberating people, there would be no problems of economics at all. Because people would keep coming. As soon as you got rid of people, like a doctor who gets rid of people becomes famous. Because they're cured. And so if in a certain church scene, people are cured and they all therefore leave the church, more come in. There's a perpetual tide of more people. So you get a huge turnover. And that's the way to work it. That's the idea of the raft. Now then, the fourth noble truth is called marga. This word means path. And the way of Buddhism is often called the Noble Eightfold Path, because there are eight phases. I won't say steps, because they're not sequential. They're all simultaneous. Once upon a time, there's a very, very great Japanese scholar, D.T. Suzuki, who was giving a lecture at the University of Hawaii on Buddhism, and was explaining he'd come to the Fourth Noble Truth. And he said, today we come to Fourth Noble Truth, called a Noble Eightfold Path. First step of Noble Eightfold Path, called Shoken. He was using Japanese name. Shoken mean right view. Aura Buddhism is right view. Right view mean no particular view, no fixed view. Or Buddhism, Shoken, right view. Second step of Noble Eightfold Path. Oh, I forget second step. You look it up in the book. Now, this man was one of the most terrific scholars in Chinese, Sanskrit, Tibetan, Japanese, and so on. So I'm not going to bother you with all the individual steps of the Eightfold Path. It really, all of them are subsumed under three headings, of which you can say that right view, which in Sanskrit is samyak, samyak is a very curious phrase. It doesn't mean right in our sense of correct. Sam is the same really as our word sum, total, complete, all-inclusive. We might use the word integrated, as when we say a person has integrity. That a person who has integrity, we mean he's all of a piece. He's not divided against himself. So, in this sense of samyak, drishti, this is related to the word darshan, which means a point of view or viewing. When you go to visit a great guru or teacher, you have darshan, you look at him, and you offer your reverence to him. This is darshan. Many senses of it, but it means simply to view. Look at the view. So the samyak darshan is the complete view. For example, let's take the constellation called the Big Dipper. We look at it from a fairly restricted zone in space, and it always seems, whatever the season of the year, because we're so far away from it, that those stars in the Big Dipper are in the same position. But imagine looking at it from somewhere else in space altogether, and those stars would not look like a dipper. They'd be in another position. Now then, what is the true position of those stars? Don't you see there isn't one? Because wherever you look, the position alters. You could say that the true situation of those stars is how they are looked at from all points of view, all possible points of view. Inside the constellation, looking outwards, outside the constellation, looking inwards, from everywhere and everywhere. But you see, there is no such thing as the truth. The world, in other words, is not existing independently of those who witness it. Because the world is precisely the relationship between the world and its witnesses. Just as the sound of a drum is the relationship between a striking hand and the skin. If there's no skin on the drum, it doesn't make any sound. And so if there are no eyes in this world, the sun doesn't make any light, nor do the stars. So what is a relationship. You can, for example, prop up two sticks by leaning them against each other, and they will stand. But only by depending on each other. Take one away and the other falls. So in Buddhism it is taught that everything in this universe depends on everything else. That we have a kind of a huge network, and this is called the doctrine of mutual interdependence. All of it hangs on you, and you hang on all of it, just as the two sticks support each other. And this is conveyed in a symbol which is called Indra's net. Imagine a multidimensional spider's web in the early morning covered with dewdrops. And every dewdrop contains the reflection of all the other dewdrops. And in each reflected dewdrop, the reflections of all the other dewdrops in that reflection. And so ad infinitum. That is the Buddhist conception of the universe. In an image. The Japanese call that jiji muge. A ji means a thing event. A happening. So between happening and happening, mu, there is no ge, separation. Jiji muge. Now, so the first phase of the Eightfold Path has to do with one's view, understanding of the world. The second phase has to do with action, how you act. And here we get the Buddhist view of behavior. A Buddhist doesn't base his ethics on the idea of commandments, of orders from a higher echelon of authority. Buddhist idea of ethics is based on expediency. If you are engaged in the way of liberation, and you want to clarify your consciousness, doing that is inconsistent with certain kinds of action. So every Buddhist makes five vows, five precepts. And you may perhaps have heard the Buddhist formula of taking what is called Panchasila, the five precepts, and they take what are called Tisarana, the three refuges, and the five precepts. The refuges are the Buddha, the Dharma, the doctrine, and the Sangha, the fellowship of all those who are on the way. So the priest, the bhikkhu, the Buddhist monk, and the lay people will chant the formula. Buddhaṃ saraṇaṃ gacchāmi, Dhammaṃ saraṇaṃ gacchāmi, Sanghaṃ saraṇaṃ gacchāmi. Those are the three refuges, the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Sangha. Then they take the five precepts. Pāṇātipātā vairamaṇī sikkhāpadaṃ samādhiyāmi. Adinadana veramani sikapadam samadhiyami. Kamesu michachara veramani sikapadam samadhiyami. Musavada Vermani Sikapadanga Samadhyami Kamesu Michahara Surameria Majapamadatana Vermani Sikapadam Samadhyami. So they take these five precepts. Panatipata. I undertake the precept to abstain from taking life. Adinadana. I undertake the precept to abstain from taking what is not given. Kamesu Michahara. I undertake the precept to abstain from exploiting the passions. Musavada. I undertake the precept to abstain from falsifying speech. Sura Merya Majapamadatana. I undertake the precept to abstain from being intoxicated by Sura, Merya, and Majapamadatana, whatever they were. I presume toddy, which is alcohol. I don't know what else it was. Nobody does know. Because, you see, if you start killing people or taking life, you're in trouble. You set up an opposition and you've got to become involved in taking care of it. If you start stealing, you worry people. You upset people's orientation in life, because if you suddenly come into the back home for dinner and find somebody's stolen your table, where are you going to serve dinner? If you exploit your passions, it means that when you feel bored and somehow that life is a little bit empty, you say, well, now what are we going to do this evening? Let's go and get stuffed. You know, a lot of people who suffer from obesity are trying to simply fill their empty psyche by stuffing themselves with food. Well, it's the wrong cure. So, likewise, Musavada, if you start telling lies to everybody, you know what happens when you start telling lies. You have to tell extra lies to cover up the first one, and you get into the most hopeless misunderstanding. Speech collapses. And, of course, the intoxication is the same problem as the exploitation of the passions. So there's a purely kind of practical, expedient, utilitarian approach to morals. There's another side to this which doesn't enter into the precepts, which I will explain later. Then the third phase has to do with your mind, with your state of consciousness. And this has to do with what we would ordinarily call meditation. There are the two final, the seventh and eighth aspects of the path are called Samyak Smriti and Samyak Samadhi. Smriti means recollection. That's the best English word for it. Now, do you understand the word recollect? Is to gather together what has been scattered. What is the opposite of remember? Obviously, dismember. What has been chopped up and scattered becomes remembered. So in the Christian scheme, do this in remembrance of me. You see, the Christ has been sacrificed, chopped up. But the Mass is celebrated in remembrance. One of the old liturgies says the wheat which has been scattered all over the hills and grows up is gathered again into the bread. Remembered. Go back to your Hindu basis. The world is regarded as the dismemberment of the self, the Brahman, the Godhead. The one is dismembered into the many. So remembrance is realizing again that each single member of the many is really the one. So that's recollection.
You're it. continues with Session 11, An Introduction to Buddhism.
When I was a small boy, I used to haunt that section of London around the British Museum. And one day I came across a shop which had a notice over the window which said, Philosophical Instruments. Even as a boy, I knew something about philosophy, but I couldn't imagine what philosophical instruments could be. So I went up to the window, and there displayed were chronometers, slide rules, scales, and all kinds of what we would now call scientific instruments. Because science used to be called natural philosophy. Because, as Aristotle says, the beginning of philosophy is wonder. Philosophy is man's expression of curiosity about everything, his attempt to make sense of the world primarily through his intellect. That is to say, his faculty for thinking. And thinking, of course, is a word used in extremely many ways and is a very vague word for most people. But I use the word thinking now and hereafter, you must understand this, in a very precise way. By thinking, as distinct from feeling or emoting, or sensing, I mean the manipulation of symbols, whether they be words, whether they be numbers, or whether they be other such signs as, say, triangles, squares, circles, astrological signs, or whatever. These are symbols. Sometimes a symbol is a little bit more concrete and less abstract than that, as when you get a mythological symbol, like a dragon. But all these things are symbols, and the manipulation of symbols to represent events going on in the real world is what I call thinking. So, philosophy in the Western sense means generally an exercise of the intellect, and the manipulation of symbols is very largely, until we come to poetry and music, an exercise of the intellect. But it does sometimes go beyond that, as in these specific cases of poetry and music. But what philosophy has become today in the academic world is something extremely restricted. Philosophy, by and large, in the academic world of both the United States and England, Germany, France to some extent, is falling into two other disciplines, mathematical logic on the one hand and linguistics on the other. And the departments of philosophy throughout the academic world have bent over backwards to be as scientific as possible. As William Earle, who was professor of philosophy at Northwestern University, said in an essay called Notes on the Death of a Culture, that an academic philosopher today must above all things avoid being edifying. He must never stoop to lying awake at nights considering problems of the nature of the universe and the destiny of man, because these have largely been dismissed as metaphysical or meaningless questions. So, unworthy of a scientific philosopher who arrives at his office at 9 o'clock in the morning dressed in a business suit carrying a briefcase and does philosophy until 5 in the afternoon, at which point he goes home to cocktails and dinner and dismisses the whole matter from his head. And William Earle adds, he would wear a white coat to work if he could get away with it. This is, of course, a little exaggerated, but this, by and large, is what departmental academic philosophy has become. And Oriental philosophy is simply not philosophy in that sense. These things, Hinduism, Buddhism, and so on, are sometimes also called religions. And I question the application of that word to them, because, again, I like to use the word religion rather strictly. I'm not going to be so bold as to venture a definition of religion, which is supposed to be true for all time. All I can do is to tell you how I use the word religion. And I want to use it in an exact sense from its Latin root, which really means a bond or rule of life. And therefore, the most correct use of the word religion is when we say of a man or woman that he or she has gone into religion, that is to say, has joined a religious or monastic order, and is living under a rule of life, living a life of obedience. For religion, if Christianity is a religion, if Judaism is a religion, if Islam is a religion, they are based on the idea of man's obedient response to a divine revelation. And thus, religion as we understand it in these three forms of religion consists really of three things. We will call them the three C's, the creed, the code, and the cult. The creed is the divinely revealed map of the universe, the nature of things, the revelation of the existence of God, of Allah, Yahweh, or as we say, God, and his existence, and his will, and his design of the universe, the creed. To this we add the second C, the code, the divinely revealed law or exemplar which man is supposed to follow. In the case of Christianity, there's a certain variation in this, because the principal revelation of the code aspect of things in Christianity, as well as the cult, is not so much a law as a person. God is said in Christianity to be supremely revealed in the historic Jesus of Nazareth. And so the code here becomes really the following of Jesus of Nazareth, not so much in obedience to a law as through the power of divine grace. Then finally, the cult. This is the divinely revealed method or way of worship, so that man relates himself to God by prayers, by rites, and by sacraments, which in these particular religions are not supposed to be so much man's way of worshiping God as God's way of loving himself, in which man is involved. So in the Christian religion, say in the Mass, would say that we worship God with God's own worship, following the saying of Meister Eckhart, that great German mystic, the love with which I love God is the same love wherewith God loves me. So too, when monks in a monastery recite the divine office using the Psalms as the basis of it. The Psalms are supposed to be the songs of the Holy Spirit. And so in using the Psalms, the idea is that you worship God with God's own words, and thereby become a sort of flute through which the divine breath plays. Now, neither Hinduism, Buddhism, nor Taoism can possibly be called religions in this sense, because all three of them significantly lack the virtue of obedience. They do not conceive the Godhead as related to mankind or to the universe in a monarchical sense. For you see, there are various models of the universe which men have used from time to time, and the model which lies behind the Judeo-Christian tradition, if there really is such a thing, is a political model. Using the metaphor of the relation of an ancient Near Eastern monarch to his subjects. And he imposes his authority and his will upon his subjects from above by power, whether it be physical power or spiritual power. And so it is thus that in the, say, the Anglican Church, when the priest at morning prayer addresses the throne of grace, he says, Almighty and everlasting God, King of kings, Lord of lords, the only ruler of princes, who dost from thy throne behold all the dwellers upon earth, most heartily we beseech thee with thy favor to behold our sovereign majesty Elizabeth the Queen and all the royal family. Now, what are these words? This is the language of court flattery. And the title King of Kings, as a title of God, was borrowed from the Persian emperors. The Cyrus of Persia, the Kyrios, hence Kyrie eleison, Lord have mercy upon us, is a kind of image drawn from things earthly and applied to things heavenly. God as the monarch. And therefore, between the monarch and the subject, there is a certain essential difference of kind, what we might call an ontological difference, so that God is God, and all those creatures, whether angels or men or other kinds of existence which God has created, are not God. There is this vast metaphysical gulf lying between the two domains. That gives us, as citizens of the United States, some problems. Because, as a citizen of the United States, you have believed, and do believe, that a republic is the best form of government. How can this be maintained if the government of the universe is a monarchy? For surely, in that case, a monarchy will be the best form of government. And many of the conflicts in our society arise from the fact that although we are running a republic, many of the members of this republic believe, or believe that they ought to believe, that the universe is a monarchy. And therefore, they are above all insistent upon obedience to law and order. If there should be democracy in the kingdom of God, that would seem to them the most subversive idea ever conceived. Now, I'm exaggerating this standpoint a little bit, just for effect, because there are some subtle modifications which one can introduce theologically, but I won't go into them at the moment. Now, there are at least two other models of the universe which have been highly influential in human history. One is dramatic, where God is not the skillful maker of the world, standing above it as its artificer and king, but where God is the actor of the world, as an actor of a stage play, the actor who is playing all the parts at once. And this is essentially the Hindu model of the universe. Everybody is God in a mask. And, of course, as you know, our own word, person, is from the Latin per sona, that through which comes sound. And this word was used for the masks worn by actors in the Greco-Roman theatre, which, being an open-air theatre, required a projection of the voice, so the actors wore masks with megaphonic mouths. And so the word person has, however, in the course of time, come to mean the real you. There was a very serious mistake made in translation from Greek to Latin when one began to talk about the three persons of the Holy Trinity. The three masks of God wasn't quite the right idea, because the Greek word was hypostasis, not a word prosopon, which would have meant properly translated person. Hypostasis is a very difficult word to translate. You could say that ice, water, and steam were three hypostases of the same thing. And that would be a little better analogy, not too good. But in Hindu thought, every individual, as a person, is a mask, but fundamentally a mask of the Godhead. A mask of a Godhead who, although the actor behind all parts, the player of all games, is indefinable for the same reason that you can't bite your own teeth. For the same reason that you can't look straight into your own eyes. You can never get at it, because it's the middle of everything. The circle whose center is everywhere and whose circumference is nowhere. Then a third model of the universe, which is characteristically Chinese, is that the world is an organism. And a world which is an organism has no boss, even no actor. Because you see, in any organism, there isn't really a boss or top organ. We are accustomed, of course, in our culture, to think of our heads as ruling the rest of the body. But there could well be an argument about this. I'm going to put up a case that the stomach is chief. Because the stomach, the sort of alimentary tract with a digesting process in it, is surely anterior to brains. There may be some sort of rudimentary nervous system attached to a stomach organization. But it's the more primitive you get, the more you get a little creature that eats. See? It's a sort of tube. And in go things at one end and out the other. And that, because that wears the tube out, the tube finds means of reproducing itself to make more tubes, so that this process of in and out can be kept up. But in the course of evolution, at one end of the tube is developed a ganglion, which eventually develops eyes and ears and has a brain in it. The better to scrounge around for food. And so the stomach point of view is that the brain is the servant of the stomach to help it scrounge around for food. But the other argument is this. True, the brain is a later development than the alimentary tract. But the alimentary tract is to the brain as John the Baptist to Jesus Christ, the forerunner of the big event. And the reason for all the scrounging around and stomach and stuff is eventually to evolve a brain. And man shall eventually live primarily for the concerns of the brain, that is, for art and science and all forms of culture, and the stomach shall be servant. Now, cynical people like dialectical materialists say that's a lot of hogwash. It's really all history is a matter of economics, and that's a matter of the stomach. It's a big argument, and you can't decide it. Because you can't, at this stage, have a stomach without a brain or a brain without a stomach. They go together like a back and a front. So the principle of organism is rather like this. An organism is a system, of a differentiated system, but it has no parts. That is to say, the heart is not a part of the body in the sense that a distributor is part of an automobile engine. Because although surgeons are trying to treat the body as a machine with replaceable parts, they're having great difficulty doing this. They may succeed one of these days. But the difficulty is that these are not parts in the sense that they are screwed in. In other words, when the fetus arises in the womb, there are not a lot of mechanics in there who are lugging in hearts and stomachs and things and fitting them together and screwing them to each other. An organism develops like a crystal in solution or a photographic plate in chemicals. It develops all over at once, and there isn't a boss in it, because all of them act together in a strange way. It's a kind of orderly anarchy. And this is the Chinese view of the world, fundamentally. This principle of organic growth they call Dao. That's pronounced Dao. If it had an apostrophe after it, it would be pronounced Tao. But Dao is more or less the right pronunciation for that word. This Chinese word is usually translated the course of nature, or the way. The way it does it. The process of things. And that, again, you see, is really very different from the Western idea of God the ruler. Of the Tao, Lao Tzu says, the great Tao flows everywhere, both to the left and to the right. It loves and nourishes all things, but does not lord it over them. And when merits are accomplished, it lays no claim to them. And so the Chinese expression for nature becomes a word which we will translate self-so. Or zi lian, What happens of itself? Like when you have hiccups. You don't plan to have hiccups, it just happens. When your heart beats, you don't plan it, it happens of itself. When you breathe, you can pretend that you are breathing, but most of the time you're not thinking about it, and your lungs breathe of themselves. So the whole idea of nature is something happening of itself without a governor is the organic theory of the world. So you see, we have these two others, the dramatic theory and the organic theory. And therefore I feel that ways of life which use these models are so unlike Christianity, Judaism, or Islam that we cannot really use the word religion of these things. Now, what is there in Western culture that resembles the concerns of Buddhism and Hinduism and Taoism? Because the trouble is, from the outside, they look alike. In other words, you go into a Hindu temple, or especially a Japanese Buddhist temple, and you'll be pretty convinced you're in church, in sort of a Catholic church at that. Because there's incense, chants, bowings, gongs, candles, rosaries, and all the things that one associates with a theistic, monarchical religion. And yet, that isn't what's going on. There isn't the factor of obedience. Even though the image of Buddha may be sitting on a throne, covered with a canopy, and royal honors being done, there's still something different. Well, I suppose that at a long shot, probably the nearest thing to these ways of life in the West is perhaps psychotherapy in some form. Not all forms of psychotherapy. Because the objective of psychotherapy is, as you might say, to change where your head's at. Is to change your state of consciousness. If you, in other words, you are horribly depressed, if you are terrified, if you are under hallucinations, you see a head shrinker. And he tries to change your state of consciousness. And so, fundamentally, these disciplines, these oriental ways, are concerned, basically, with changing your state of consciousness. Only, here we part company. Psychotherapy is largely focused on the problems of the individual as such. The problems peculiar to this individual or that individual. These Asian ways of life are focused on certain problems peculiar to man as such, to every individual. On the understanding that the average human being, and the more civilized he is, the more this is true, that the average human being is hallucinating. That he has a delusive sense of his own existence. And it is thus that the very word Buddha in Buddhism is from a root in Sanskrit, Buddha, which means to awake, to awaken. To awaken from the illusion is then to undergo a radical change of consciousness with regard to one's own existence. It is to cease being under the impression that you are just poor little me. To find out who you really are, or what you really are, behind the mask.